Good morning. Let's get straight to markets.
Take a look at the impact for the indices.
Factual. Succinct. All you need to know before your trading day starts. Subscribe to our newsletter, CNBC's Daily Open.
Welcome to Beyond the Valley, a CNBC tech podcast with Arjun Karpal and Tom Chitty.
Beyond the Valley.
The halving will soon be upon us. Not some medieval ritual. The halving, which happens every 4 years, is when the rewards for mining Bitcoin are cut in half, which should reduce supply and increase demand for the cryptocurrency. Arjun's been at Paris Blockchain Week, Europe's biggest blockchain and digital assets event, to find out why the halving is so important, what it will mean for the price of Bitcoin, and how this halving cycle may be different to before. And we'll also get the latest on the future of crypto exchange Binance, and finally, whether Ethereum is the next cryptocurrency after Bitcoin to be granted an ETF.
Beyond the Valley.
So, how was Paris?
Paris was very nice. Had a delightful Parisian beer while I was there.
I knew you were going to start with either food or drink.
It had to be one of the two. It was very nice. It was whirlwind, though. You know, we sort of got in. Eurostar, love the Eurostar. Nice little handy journey. No sort of, you know, airport situation.
Now, if you'd like to keep up to date on the world of tech, then the best place to start is the Beyond the Valley weekly newsletter. Packed with the best international tech stories from CNBC, you can subscribe by heading to cnbc.com/Beyond the Valley. Click on the subscribe button and it will drop in your inbox every Friday. But before we discuss our main story, we've got to hear Arjun's stat of the week, which is
13,777.
13,777. Okay. So back to our main story. The Bitcoin halving, Arjun, for someone that's never heard of it, what is it?
Yeah, the halving or the harvening. Others call it.
That's so weird. Harvening sounds even more medieval.
Yeah, it's. I don't know. I just go with halving. It's easy to pronounce. But you have to go back to Bitcoin and the way it functions. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin in existence. And the way that Bitcoin is effectively created is this public ledger of activity. And transactions need to be validated in order to sort of go through. And this validation process is done by what are known as miners. Could be you and I, probably not you and I though, but could be you and I running very specialized, high power machines, computers that are able to solve very complex cryptographic mathematical puzzles in order to validate a Bitcoin transaction. And when they do validate a transaction, they're competing with other miners to do so. When they do validate a transaction, they're rewarded for their efforts in Bitcoin. Every 4 years, written in Bitcoin's code, is the halving, in which those rewards the miners get are slashed in half. The idea then is that the new Bitcoin that is created is cut in half. The amount of new Bitcoin created is cut in half. And so it slows down the supply of Bitcoin onto the market. It keeps a lid on inflation in the Bitcoin space. And that's the whole idea of it.
So if I go and buy Bitcoin, the Bitcoin I buy is fresh Bitcoin that's been mined, not someone who's selling Bitcoin. Is that right?
The likelihood is if you buy Bitcoin, if we go on an exchange and buy Bitcoin, we're selling Bitcoin that's in existence already. That Bitcoin may have come into circulation when the miners were rewarded with it and then sold it at some point, and it's entered into the sort of buy and sell market. But that's effectively of what it is.
Why is it so important then? Have we seen historically huge price rises off the back of it?
So it's important because I think a lot of enthusiasts of Bitcoin, just from a pure technological level, love the idea. So often people who are proponents of Bitcoin will say, well, if you look at currencies like the US dollar or something else, you know, those can, US dollar can be printed ad infinitum. you know, central banks control the supply, and you know they can print more money effectively.
Quantitative easing.
Yeah, quantitative easing is one way of doing that, and that devalues the dollar, or it devalues a currency. And so what they say is, well, with the halving, you know, Bitcoin will not be devalued. There's only a limited, finite supply, and no central bank in the world can overturn that. There's no central entity that controls Bitcoin. And so from an ideological, from a technological point of view, that's what the Bitcoin enthusiasts like. Now, from the price and market point of view, that's a different story. So when people talk about Bitcoin price, you'll often hear them talk about the Bitcoin cycle. And it's this sort of four-year cycle that happens. And often the new bull run, which has begun, starts or kind of begins just before the halving takes place. And after halving, a few months later, Bitcoin hits a new all-time high. That is the typical cycle. And the idea is that, well, if the supply of Bitcoin is becoming more finite, it's becoming rarer, just like gold or like precious metal or something, you know, that's becoming rarer, then the price would go higher. And that's the kind of thinking behind it.
Yeah, I was talking to one crypto enthusiast about it, and he said that's what makes Bitcoin special. Everything else is sort of, you know, other crypto follow, you know, similar technology, but it's the fact that, you know, there is a limited supply, and our currencies are constantly being devalued through inflation, through printing of money. People see that as, well, if I get my hands on some Bitcoin, there's no chance that there's going to be more created. You know, it will hold its value, or at least that's what they think.
Yeah. And that's from a tech and ideological point of view, that's really what so many of the enthusiasts and proponents love about it.
Let's talk a little bit about why this cycle is a little bit different then. It's to do with the ETF that happened a few months ago, right?
Yeah, that's right. So Bitcoin hit an all-time high, a new all-time high, before the halving took place. A lot of that was because, and we've spoken about the ETF in a past episode, the spot ETF approvals in the US, which has increased investor access to Bitcoin. But it also means that the issuers of those ETFs need to buy Bitcoin to underpin the ETF. So there's been a ton of demand and inflows of money into these ETFs. And, you know, to support that, those issuers are going to have to go out and buy Bitcoin. And that's really helped the price. And the excitement about that, the fact that to many, Bitcoin has gone mainstream, it is part of why we saw the all-time high hit. Now you've got the halving in the mix. What is that going to do to the market? Now, you mentioned I was at Paris Blockchain Week. In there, I had a very rare interview with the new Binance CEO, Richard Teng. We sat down in the Binance offices, and I asked him a little bit about this market cycle and how it's different.
So if you asked me last year, I have a certain price point for Bitcoin where it ended up. I would say that it exceeded my expectation, especially so early on. But this cycle is a bit different from past cycle. I mean, you have been involved in crypto, so you know. Crypto normally go through 4-year cycle, right? Price movement cycle, which coincide with the halving, which is going to take place in about 9 days' time for Bitcoin. It's normally after about 6 months after a halving that you see a new all-time high in terms of prices. But this time around, it happens even before the halving, right? Which is why it's unique in terms of market cycle. And one of the key reasons is really the introduction of the ETF, where you bring in so many new users, new liquidity.
So Richard Teng there is sort of saying very similar things. You know, the ETS pulled forward demand. He's very bullish because not only have you got that, then you've got the halving now. And so that could propel prices further. He said initially last year, he thought Bitcoin would hit something like $80,000 this year. And he goes, I'm going to probably go past that now.
So he's actually even more bullish.
That's right, because not only have you now got that ETF demand, you've now got halving. It's going to be interesting. We haven't seen a cycle like this before. Has that demand just been pulled forward because of the ETF, or is it going to be the ETF now plus the traditional impact of the halving? That remains to be seen.
Whilst you were at Paris, you chatted to a lot of crypto enthusiasts. What were some of the more outlandish price predictions. Was there anyone that was bearish? Was anyone saying, well, I expect it to go down?
No, it was a party, Tom. It was just a party. it was only going up, apparently, according to the crypto community. It's very, as a side note, it's very hard. It's a very divisive asset class, isn't it? Mm. Crypto. Yeah. You know, you've got, there's often people who like sort of despise it, or people absolutely love it, and there's nothing bad to say about it. It's very hard to find someone in the middle.
Well, that's you and I.
It's you and I. That we are. You know, one of the only comparable things I can think of is Tesla. Mm. Tesla stock. It's got, you either got people who love it, and nothing bad about it, and it's the future, or people just think it's just another car company. Fascinating. Anyway, that's what makes a market, I guess. But no, there have been outlandish price predictions this year. $100,000, $150,000, I've heard. So those are somewhere on the top end levels of predictions for this year.
When you're speaking to these crypto enthusiasts and you're a little bit playing devil's advocate and just a little bit more temperate with your, you know, questions and challenging their assertions of, you know, this is the best thing since sliced bread, what's the reaction? Is it quite, not aggressive, but is it quite, you know, on the front foot when they hear any challenges?
It's definitely on the front foot. I think it's definitely like, you know, they're up for the challenge.
Yeah.
But they're definitely on the front foot. And they want to talk up Bitcoin. Well, there's lots of pros of it that they see specifically, and they want to talk about it.
And they probably spent years being told that they're, you know, crazy and what they're investing in is, you know, worthless.
Yes.
I assume. Anyway, okay. Speaking of Binance, let's talk a little bit more about that crypto exchange. Been in the news a lot in the past 12 months. Give us a little bit of background as to why this interview is kind of pretty important, bit of an exclusive there. Give us a little bit of background on Binance.
Binance is one of the world's largest cryptocurrency exchanges. It's got a huge number of users, huge number of assets on. But last year, it was part of a lawsuit with the Department of Justice in the US. The result of that was that its former CEO, Changpeng Zhao, CZ, and we've spoken about Binance before in one of the episodes, he pleaded guilty to criminal charges levied by the DOJ, and Binance settled with the DOJ for $4.3 billion. A lot of what the DOJ had alleged was around things like not enough controls for anti-money laundering or knowing your customer and various other allegations, a long list. Then the new CEO came in, just months into the job now, Richard Teng. Now, he was is a former regulator in Abu Dhabi, so he's come from this regulatory background. And it's his task now to clean up this company. And I sat down with him, I think we spoke for about 20, 25 minutes, about some of those allegations, about what he's planning to do. One of the biggest things the DOJ talked about with Binance was its culture, and said CZ, the former CEO, had this culture where it was better to ask for forgiveness later than ask for permission. And so I spoke to Richard Teng about this and said, how do you go about changing the culture?
So in those very early stage of development, again, where rules are nascent, early stage of development, there's no clarity on that. Binance was operating in a certain fashion, right? But we have moved past that. As the company moved into greater maturity, we're looking at sustainability. The direction of travel now is very clear towards much more compliance, which is why we're building up a very robust compliance program with very good talent, right?
So his argument was, you know, a lot of what the DOJ was alleging was past behavior, you know, from the early days, was a startup culture, growth, amongst sort of everything. And now the company's maturing. They are working with regulators, and there's a lot more that they need to do to mature. I think one of his biggest challenges is really going to be about there's still a lot of the old guard left at Binance, and how do they react to this change? Will he get them on board? That could be quite a big question as well.
I think it's interesting. Startups are, by the very nature, need to push the boundaries, but can often get caught out when it comes to behavior and practices, best practices.
And a lot in the crypto industry will argue, well, you know, we don't have the regulation in place. It's hard for us to know what we can and can't do.
Yeah, and they've been calling for it.
That's the flip side of this argument, too.
Yeah, And just from your discussions, does it sound like that, you know, are they confident that that will happen? That
well, in the US, the crypto industry is just fed up with the US. Like, there's no regulation anywhere. The SEC is so anti-crypto, you know, and so they're looking that they're always, the US is so behind. That's one of the things I heard on the ground. The US is so behind. You know, other jurisdictions are already taking a lead when it comes to trying to establish an environment in which some of these crypto, blockchain, Web3, whatever companies can operate.
Subscribe to the Squawkbox Europe Express podcast. Join Steve, Karen, and myself, Arabile, in unscripted and dynamic debate around the day's top stories with first and exclusive interviews of the best in business and global newsmakers, original points of view, and instant analysis of the latest business news and key market themes. Get set for the day ahead. Squawkbox Europe Express podcast, now available on Spotify, Apple Music, and Google Podcasts.
Let's talk a little bit about ETFs again. We mentioned it earlier in the episode, but after the Bitcoin ETF, there was huge fanfare and excitement that, you know, a cryptocurrency had got an ETF, an exchange-traded fund, if you didn't know what that stands for. There was also talk about who's next, which cryptocurrency will get an ETF next. And there's been discussion that Ethereum could potentially be the next cryptocurrency. What was the news on the ground in Paris about that?
Yep, one of the world's biggest cryptocurrencies, Ether, runs, you know, basically is the token that is associated with the Ethereum blockchain. We'll do a bit more on blockchains one day, I think. But imagine Ethereum as sort of something you can build apps on, effectively, like an operating system that you can build apps on. And those apps perhaps might be using Ether tokens, for example. So there's a lot of excitement around Ethereum and the technology, and then Ether. So yeah, if you can give people access to Ether via an ETF, again, it could be seen as another big win, something that can bring a lot of money into Ether. Now, you know, I was talking to actually some of the issuers of the Bitcoin ETFs on the ground at Paris Blockchain Week about their views on whether the SEC will pass an Ether ETF. If anyone's to know, it's them. They have to work with the regulators. So I caught up with Jan Vanek, the CEO of Vanek, and Vanek is one of the issuers of the Bitcoin ETF. I also caught up with Jean-Marie Monietti, the CEO of CoinShares. Again, CoinShares, via an acquisition it did in the US, issues one of the Bitcoin ETFs in the US. Jan Vanek in particular, his company, Vanek, has also filed for an application for an Ether ETF. So I asked the both of them, starting with Mr. Vanek, what are the chances of the SEC approving an Ether ETF in this upcoming deadline that's soon in May?
And we and ARK, Kathy Wood, are kind of the first in line for May, I guess, to probably be rejected. So
you're not expecting the SEC to approve those?
No.
No.
I mean, the way the legal process goes is the regulators will give you comments on your application. And that happened for weeks and weeks before the Bitcoin ETFs. And right now, pins are dropping as far as Ethereum is concerned.
Look, I think our view is very similar to Jan. I don't see anything being approved this side of the year. I think the SEC put a very clear landing sign between, you know, what is proof of work versus proof of stake, and proof of stake is one step too complicated right now to get an approval before the election cycle.
Both of them there basically saying no chance. I thought it was interesting from Jan Vanek. He was saying, well, usually in these things we have lots of meetings with the SEC around these ETFs, etc. And he said it's just pin drops. It's nothing at the moment. So that May deadline, towards the end of May, is when the SEC is supposed to reject or approve some of these ETFs. They feel pretty confident that it's just not going to happen. And so poured a lot of cold water on that. And it's something that the market's been excited about. The problem with Ether, in the SEC's view, is there's a whole debate on whether Ether or cryptocurrency, certain cryptocurrencies, are security or not security. And that brings them into certain regulatory jurisdictions. Ether's status by the SEC has not yet been determined. It's still up in limbo. So that's one big problem. And as I mentioned, Gary Gensler, the chair of the SEC, said, look, just because we let Bitcoin ETF happen doesn't mean we're going to do this with Ether too. So a lot of headwinds, I think, for an Ether ETF. And clearly the industry, those who are actually trying to get those to pass, also think the same.
Anything else from Paris Blockchain Week?
I actually attended an AI summit the day before Paris Blockchain Week in Paris. Nice.
Okay.
Yeah.
But not related to...
Related to this event, but by the same people. But that was quite interesting. Mm. I caught up with a company called Samba Nova. They're like an NVIDIA competitor. Mm. So I thought that was quite interesting. But yeah, I think a lot of the chat around the blockchain industry is, you know, we've spoken a lot about, I think, you know, the halving and pricing and market. But a lot of them are excited about some of the applications that might come to pass on some of these blockchains and over the next year or two. They often say these bull markets are a good time to support the industry, brings money into the industry, perhaps new innovations and things like that. So we'll see what happens this year.
So it sounds like, yeah, as you mentioned, an episode on blockchain would be worthwhile. For
yeah,
sure.
I mean, there's so many more stories to dig into around that. But hopefully, you know, given the halving soon, hopefully this episode's given a bit of insight into that.
Yeah, dates, we're looking at 18th, 20th.
Yeah, something
May.
Like that. Well, it depends
April,
when that,
sorry.
You know, that block is mined effectively, then determines when the halving happens. So it's soon. I mean, you know, whoever's listening right now might be listening as the halving's happening or has happened.
True.
So, but at least hopefully it's given a bit of context on what it's all about.
Fantastic. All right. Let's leave that there. But before we finish the episode, we have, of course, got to do Stat of the Week.
13,777.
Let me...
Yeah. Last week you were sort of wildly wrong on it.
Yeah,
it wasn't
let's be
even
honest.
The same.
Let's be honest. The, yeah. The answer was, or at least the question
quite
was
random.
Was a little random.
Yeah.
The number of cryptocurrencies in the world.
Wow, you did it!
Did I get it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Nailed it.
Just pulled it
Brilliant.
Out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere.
Yeah, I know.
Are you Googling?
No, I'm
no,
not.
You're not Googling.
No, I genuinely was just
not,
reading through
searching.
The script
yeah.
thinking, what would he have asked?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, 13,777 cryptocurrencies in existence. How crazy is that?
That is. And we only really talk about, you know, several of them.
Well, there's a, you know, there's...
Or one of them.
Lots of coins themed around cats, around dogs, around other pets. There's obviously, you know, the main coins like Bitcoin, and there's stable coins. Mm-hmm. And then there's a bunch of, you know, what people call, that you mentioned earlier, meme coins.
Meme coins?
You said meme coins.
Did I?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you said
meme coins.
Okay, well, I thought I heard meme coins. But meme coins, yeah, meme coins.
What are they?
They're like these sort of jokey coins around
meme. For people investing.
People invest in them.
Wow.
Sometimes you'll see like a meme coin up like 200% in a day or something like that. It's a thing.
Speaking of, you know, price rises, I watched Dumb Money. Have you seen that?
No, it's on the list.
Yeah.
It's on the list, yeah.
A lot of our CNBC colleagues in the US make an appearance. It's about the GameStop short squeeze and, you know, the
meme
retail
stocks.
Investors.
They were called meme stocks, weren't they?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. That's where I think, you know, that's where we got meme coin.
We should do a recommend section for just, you know, tech. It's sort of, well, it's gaming related.
Tech, gaming, you know, related, literature, films.
Culture.
Yeah, culture, general culture.
Highly recommend. Very good. Very good watch. Remember, you can email us at beyondthevalley@cnbc.com. Last week we had the flight from hell story that you gave us, which was... a real treat. And I thought we'd read an email from David Hunt in direct response to that story. David says, leaving Chicago, we encountered a thunderstorm somewhere over Pennsylvania. Dark, dark skies, hard rain, lightning. We hear the cracks. We see the lightning. The plane drops. There's silence among the passengers. While we hold our breaths, a boy, maybe age 5, giggles with delight. I'm on my way to Elmira, New York, by way of NYC, New York City, where we encounter freezing rain. While delayed on the tarmac, we go through several rounds of de-icing before takeoff. We're flying directly into a snowstorm. We're rerouted to Syracuse. The snow is falling so heavily, I prepare for an announced overnight stay. Instead, a small group of us are directed to a passenger van for a whiteout drive to Elmira, 90 miles away. A couple of hours later, at about 2 a.m., we arrive at the Elmira Airport, where it's also whiteout conditions. I search for my van, park 3 days ago now, clear the snow while it snows, and drive myself home, arriving after 3 a.m.
That's a real flight from hell, that.
Yeah, poor David. But thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that. I suppose his flight is, you know, longer and more arduous and slightly scarier. Yours was just painful.
Really painful. But yeah, we won't relive that.
Yeah.
Paris was great.
Okay, great.
was the initial point.
And
it was really good.
If in doubt, you know, Eurostar's another option to fly.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it for this episode. But before we go, please follow and subscribe to the show. Thank you, Arjun.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll be back next week for another episode of Beyond the Valley. Goodbye.
Beyond the Valley.